It's time for Hanson McLean Advisors Money Matters, hosted by Scott Hanson and Pat McLean, credentialed financial advisors serving you since 1993.
Welcome to Hanson McLean's Money Matters. I'm Scott Hanson.
I'm Pat McLean. Thanks for joining us this weekend.
Yeah, we're very grateful, actually, for joining us. Both myself and my co-host here, we're both financial advisors, certified financial planner, chartered financial consultant. We spend our weekdays with people like yourself, helping them plan their financial future. We come here on the weekends to be your financial advisors on the air. So one of the things you'll notice about our program is we like to take calls from people around the region and help them with their finances. This isn't just a one-way program where we're spewing information at you.
And when we say around the region, increasingly we're getting many more calls from around the United States based upon this internet thing that seems to be catching on.
Well, that's when I said region, because what region are we
region?
Talking about?
Actually, when
Twin Lakes region, tri-state region.
Actually, if you've ever talked to someone like the cable company or AT&T cellular or whatever, I always like to ask them, where are you located? And they always say centrally located. We're centrally located.
That's their answer?
Yeah. Centrally located.
You mean when there's like a 2-second delay and they have a strong accent? Oh, what down in San Diego, sir?
That's a terrible accent.
The call center's in San Diego.
No, they say centrally. But anyway, so we take your calls, and we'll take them throughout the show.
That's right. And, of course, we enjoy doing what we do here. And we've been doing the program for almost 20 years. Yeah. And
It's been fun.
For the most part, it's good, and I think most of our listeners enjoy the program. Anyway, so...
Or they wouldn't listen. Well, that kind of makes sense.
Well, they would have tuned off by now?
Yeah, that's the point, yes.
Anyway, we've got a great program lined up. Who says they have a bad program now that I'm thinking about it? It's always good.
We have a mediocre program lined up.
It's not going to be one of our best.
We're not going to put it all in today. We're going to be at the highest level of mediocrity.
Yeah.
That's us.
We might answer some questions correctly. Some we might not even
It could go any way. You're going to have to listen to find out. It's just like the health bill. You're going to have to listen to find out.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing all the news that comes out.
Oh, every year with the enrollment?
Whatever.
Oh, it just fills the airways.
Huh?
It fills the airways. It does fill the air with. Are you drinking a cup of coffee there, Scott?
No.
Huh? Holy smokes, you've got to turn that.
I turned it on.
Are you okay?
I turned my mic. No, it's not okay. If I was okay, I wouldn't be coughing like that. I went down the wrong pipe. I'm drinking a cup of hot tea because my voice, I'm trying to have a good radio voice today. No, I've got.
A radio voice. I heard you doing your scales earlier, lobby.
What?
Your vocal scales. Do you warm up for the show with vocal scales? I always warm up with the show with vocal scales.
Oh, yeah. Always warming up with vocal scales. I did it. Actually, in high school, I was in a choir.
You were in a choir? Is that right? Was this pre or post purple hair, Scott?
I never had purple hair.
I thought you had dyed hair.
It was black for a period of time when I was like 19, but it was not purple.
It was dyed black.
You know, there's some things that I disclose to the public. Some things I just disclose to some close friends.
It's all...
Most of my close friends have some discretion about some certain things.
Well, if I've offended you, I apologize.
No, you haven't offended. No, I sang in it was the church had a big youth group and they had a choir thing, and I remember I even had a lead role at one point in time.
Really?
But I got to tell you. Every once in a while, I'll have a dream. Like, I'll have a dream that it's college, and it's, like, a week before finals, and I forgot to, I didn't even go to the class.
Yeah, you missed the class. Dreams? Oh, yeah, all the time.
And I'll sometimes have a dream where it's, like, tomorrow's the performance.
Oh.
Where it's, like, a musical-type thing or a play, because I've done some of those things when I was younger as well. And I haven't done any rehearsing. I haven't read my lines. I have no idea what's going on. And, you wake up in like a cold sweat because you don't know what's happening. Anyway, why am I mentioning this?
Let's talk about vocal scales.
I don't think we need to get our numbers out.
All right. Oh, we need to give out the numbers. If you'd like to join the show,
vocal scales
916 916-921-1530, or 1-800-834-1530. So if you have any questions regarding your financial situation, if someone is pitching you some sort of an investment product and you want a second opinion, or if you're getting ready to retire and you wonder whether you have enough, refinancing mortgages, life insurance, does it make sense? Should you own it? Should you not own it? If you should own it, you know, there's 27 different flavors of life insurance. What kind should you own? We'll take your calls here, 916-921-1530. And we will get you on the air, and especially tax
this
questions.
This is the strangest
this time
thing.
Of year.
My screen does not have, I've seen these calls, I have no name on them. You've got them on your screen.
Oh, so I'll take the call.
I thought something was wrong.
Let's talk to...
And I'm like, what in the world is going on? I see people calling. There's no...
Let's talk to Jay. Jay, thanks for joining Hanson McClain. What can we do for you?
Yeah, hi, good morning. I just had a question. I recently received four or five small amounts of life insurance from a family member passing away, and I didn't know. They're like General America, MetLife, those type of insurance policies.
Uh-huh.
And is there tax implications on there? I was always under the understanding there's no taxation on life insurance, but maybe I'm wrong.
In most cases, there's no taxations on life insurance. And in this particular case, there would be no taxation on life insurance. There
okay.
are a few rare cases where life insurance is taxable, and that is if it is actually owned by a pension plan, the life insurance proceeds are taxable. Or if you have a very large estate, those life insurance policies could have estate taxes.
Or if somebody buys a policy, they have no insurable interest, and they're buying it purely from an investment. So, for example, if you bought, if let's say your neighbor said, hey, I don't want my policy anymore, I'm going to cancel it, would you like to buy it from me instead? And you said, sure, I'll buy the policy from you. Then at that point, it's now an investment. It's not going to be taxed. It won't be tax-free. It'll be.
But 99.9% of the time, life insurance policies are not income tax. You pay no income taxes, and that is especially in your case with these little policies that came from a relative. There's no taxes on those.
Okay, and I had one other question.
Sure.
Yeah, you know, I was reading recently that Arnold Schwarzenegger and all these type of politicians, they put their money in some type of trust or something that they have no part of it. And I always wondered, these guys with like buku bucks, you're a multimillionaire, and they walk away from them, and it's managed. And, you know, like the common working guy like me, obviously can never get those type of returns. And they'll say like, oh, they made $28 million for the year. And, of course, they have hundreds of millions of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
But what kind of money management or what kind of stocks or bonds or whatever they're into to have such huge returns versus on a just a common working guy that doesn't get much return
okay.
so, at all?
So, Jay, you asked two questions. One is the first question, which is these politicians, they put these monies into a trust. They put them into what are called blind trust.
Some do.
Yeah, some do.
A lot of them do not.
Some say they do and then don't.
Okay.
Some put part of their portfolios in blind trust and some don't. But a blind trust is just the kind of it's where you give money management over to someone else and
right.
you actually can look at the returns, but you actually can't look at the holding. So you don't know what that person you entrusted to manage the money.
Most politicians don't. I mean, the president has a blind trust. I think just about everybody else. That's why continue to have these scandals. It's like their spouse is involved in a company that they're drafting legislation on and everything else.
But that's a blind trust. And then the second question is, you know, where did these people get these outsized returns in this private equity? The reality is
Hoyt cattle, not Hoyt. What was the cattle that Hillary was involved in?
Oh yeah,
Whitewater, whatever. It's one scandal. After
but the
another.
Reality is. Oftentimes, their returns as a percentage of the portfolios are no greater than the average investors.
Okay, yeah.
And matter of fact, here in California, when you've got over half of the income revenue, tax revenue, coming from the top 1%, you can really see what happens during, for example, the last economic downturn. the incomes drop substantially for the wealthiest as well. So they don't necessarily, I mean, you can invest exactly how Warren Buffett invests if you buy Berkshire Hathaway.
Right.
But, and when you set about, when people set these things in trust, it doesn't necessarily help them tax wise either. Because trust, and if it's an irrevocable trust, their tax rates are actually worse than individual income tax rates.
So,
all right.
All right. Appreciate the call, Jay.
Thank
yeah.
you.
All right. But I think that, you know, the cynical side of me says that a lot of politicians have access to investment knowledge that the average person doesn't have because.
Well, which makes you a good investment advisor is the fact that you're cynical. If you weren't cynical, you wouldn't be a good investment advisor.
No. Oh, Scott, he's such a cynical guy.
You don't have to be vocally cynical, but you're certainly cynical. Should be cynical as an investment advisor.
Suspect of everything. We need to take a break. 921-1530 if you want to join us. Again, 921-1530. You're listening to Hanson McClain's Money Matters. Welcome back to Hanson McClain's Money Matters. I'm Scott Hanson.
I'm Pat McClain.
It's a good weekend. It's always a good weekend when I have a nice run.
So, going into I said that a good investment advisor is a little cynical, and you said suspect. A good investment advisor should be suspect. Yeah, I think that's both true. I don't think the big difference between cynical and suspect is that far.
Someone who's a cynic, I tend to view as somebody who's maybe got a little bit of chip on their shoulder. Life's kind of treat them the wrong way, so now they're cynical of everything.
Okay.
And that's why I don't think – I wouldn't want to surround my life with a bunch of cynics.
But you would like to surround yourself with people that are suspect of everything?
Absolutely.
Okay. No, but a good investment advisor has a tendency to – the best investment advisors I know don't take everything at face value.
Oh, absolutely.
They don't, and most of the time, they don't believe the stories.
Well, those stories, come on, particularly the stuff the media spews out, or even
the investment community spews.
So I remember being in a meeting not long ago, and we were talking about something, and somebody said, "Yeah, well, but if you look at all the money that private equity is going into the space, so they must believe something about this." And I said, "Ho ho ho! Just because there's a lot of private equity, many different private equity firms, highly educated people." Making investment decisions does not mean it's a good investment because they all might be believing the same hype as everybody else. I mean, clearly saw this in the financial crisis in the mortgage market.
We saw it in real estate.
Highly educated people.
We saw it on tech stocks.
People can have a tendency to do whatever. They have their own biases. Then they find research to back up their biases.
To support their bias.
Correct.
Yeah, well, that's human nature.
That is where you need to be suspect from an investment standpoint. That's where you really need to be questioning yourself, like, wait, am I actually doing the research on this because this is my premise and I want to get some research to back up my premise?
Or just trying to prove my... So you're not testing in statistics. They would call it not testing for the null hypothesis.
Oh, the null hypothesis. statistics, but yeah.
Well, you're a college student.
Do you
test for the null hypothesis? Always. Thank you.
My son took a statistics class.
In high school?
He took a statistics class online over the summertime.
Really? In high school?
Yes.
93%.
Way too motivated.
93% of the statistics classes online are not real.
Well, we need to test that. Should have tested.
All right, let's go to the
To join the program, 921-1530. That'll get you on the air here.
How'd he do?
916. I think he got a B because his first test, it was an AP class, so he got extra, so it's a 4.0 still.
Your kid is really smart.
He works hard at it. I was not motivated in high school at all. And some people might find that a surprise because I seem fairly motivated in life now. But for whatever reason, in high school...
You were saving it up for when you were older.
I don't know if I should tell this story. I'm going to tell it because it's full disclosure here. I had a trigonometry class in high school. I think it was my junior year. And the first day, the teacher laid out his grading schedule. And it was this point system. And I looked at the point system and I realized if I got an A on the first test... I can get an F on everything else, mm-hmm. and I was guaranteed a C in the class.
And what'd you do?
I got an A on the first test, and I never did a piece of work after that.
You are smart and lazy.
And every day I'd come by looking at homework, and I just look at him and smile. And I look back now, I'm like, what was I thinking? I
mean, you were in class.
My home life was a little unstable. At the time. I don't know
you
what
were
my,
in class. Like, you could have gotten it done. You could have done put in.
Oh, come on. I could have got an A in the class. I mean, math, I love math. But I don't know if it was kind of a quiet rebellion. It was. I knew I had to get through high school. I don't know. I look back now. I'm just thankful my son's not that way.
Yeah,
it took me a little extra work to kind of get back on track. You know, that's not a good way to necessarily go through life. I mean,
okay.
Anyway.
And we're going to take a couple
calls.
Enough
about my life. Let's hear.
We're going to take a couple calls, yeah, and after the calls, we're going to come back to
Scott's life. High school experience.
Problems with Scott's adolescence.
I'd go and get the hall pass every this class, and he got to the point, it's like, hey, Scott, yeah, take your time. Take all period if you'd like. Okay, and I'd go get a little cup of coffee with two sugars.
How do you feel about
it,
that now?
And a cinnamon roll.
How do you feel about that now? You feel like calling the teacher and apologizing?
You know what? I got to look back. How frustrating for high school teachers to have students like me.
Yeah, where they
obviously
know you.
Obviously, I was smart enough.
Yeah, but you just had no drive, and he just quit trying. And you quit trying. Everyone quit trying. Let's talk to...
We all quit trying.
Everyone, let's just take the day off. Let's talk to Philip. Philip, thanks for joining Hanson McLean, and thank you for your patience in tolerating problems with Scott's adolescence.
Oh.
Hey guys, good morning. How's it going?
Good.
Super.
My question has to do with at my work, we currently have a 401k match, and our employers offered for us to change over to a pension. And there's five of us, and we're all different age ranges, and we have to decide collectively what we want to do.
Wait. So is this a small company?
You said five employees.
It's a large company, but the site that we work at is small. So there's different sites all over the country. In our particular site, there's only five of us here.
And tell me about the pension they're offering.
Is this must be different ownership structure at each site or something?
Yeah, it's we came into a union agreement late on.
Got it.
And we negotiated a 401k, and that's kind of what we like. And
so tell me about the pension they're offering.
What's the match right now you're getting, first of all?
We're getting a 7% match, and the pension offers it's structured for 5 years at a time, and right now it's about it calculates out to about $540 monthly. If you were to get the 5 years maximum benefit just for that 5 years,
so it's 500. So this is a pretty complicated question.
It is,
but it can get, here's how it gets simple. Okay.
Okay.
If you're an older employee, it's going to be a good deal for you. If you're a younger employee, it's not going to be a good deal. So if there's five people. The one in the age, and I'm assuming the company's not going to be contributing any additional dollars. That's my assumption. It'll be about what they're contributing now. The one whose age is in the middle, he or she can be neutral on it. The two that are older want this. The two that are younger do not want this.
Because it's $540 that he paid out at a particular age, correct?
Right. And that's my calculations were kind of like if you took it 5 years and then you were to retire early, it would be a great deal for them compared to a 401k match over the next 5 or 10 years. But
How old are you?
I'm the youngest. I'm 35.
Oh, no. You don't want this.
So because what happens is that it's basically they're going to pay in for 5 years, and then they're going to defer that pension until you're age 60 or 62 or 65, correct?
Right. The only other assumption that I had that might be a benefit is if you paid into it for 30 years, it seems to work out better than if you were to get a 7% match over 30 years.
That may be true. That may be true, but you don't have a guarantee of that. Right?
Right.
So
my guess is the employer is not contributing additional dollars. So you take yourself over the next 5 years, you're gonna vest for $540 a month pension, right? You'll be 41 at that time. You need to wait another 20 years.
Right.
Well, the present value of $540, if you back it down 20 years.
It's not that much.
No, it's not that much money.
Where the present value of that 7% match is dollars
in hand
today.
You can then let grow for the next 20-some-odd years.
I agree with Scott. It's not in your best interest. If you were 58, probably. But you're not.
But you need to find a way to lobby the guy in the middle that this is not a
good
deal.
Well, and that's the thing is everybody likes the 401k. Even the older guys, they like the 401k just for the control. And
yeah. And
I don't even think they're going to, some of them are, you know, they're 67. They might retire in 2 years from now. So they're not really interested in 5 years even.
Got it.
All right. Well, good. Then I would not take this thing.
And there's nothing hidden that we're overlooking.
No. And most of the time in this environment, it's a push for the company, or they wouldn't be offering it.
I guarantee. Because it's not a savings for the company.
When it seems
like that, maybe they get kickbacks from the pension or something. Oh. They seem like they would rather us go over to the pension.
Then maybe it's less money.
Yeah, when you first asked the question, I thought there must be something wrong here because companies are trying to get rid of pensions, not actually install them.
Yeah, yeah.
Less than 15% of all non-public employees have defined benefit pensions. So anyway, appreciate the call.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
All right, and we'll see. Usually when the companies come up with some...
That's cynical.
What?
When the companies come up with what?
A pension change, it's to your detriment and to their benefit.
That's cynical.
It's real.
Okay, it is real, but okay. It is still cynical.
All right.
It's normally not in your best interest. It's either them trying to release themselves of liability, long-term liability, or to get costs down.
Yeah. All right, let's talk to John. John, you're with Hanson McLean Advisors.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I really like your show.
Thanks.
So as we're getting older and we're sort of approaching critical mass and we're doing all right, one of my strategies has been to put a lot of money into our retirement accounts, tax deferred. So we have some in IRAs and a lot in 401k type vehicles, 403b, 457s. So I always thought I would roll those over into IRAs when our employment ended.
Mm-hmm.
Thinking that one of the reasons to keep it in retirement accounts is that it's all insulated from liability if you were ever sued and had a damage award or things like that. So an attorney recently told me that that's not necessarily true with IRAs, that the judge has some discretion and that he basically, in California, can say, oh, you have $1 million in your IRA accounts, Mr. and Mrs. X. You only need $300,000 for the rest of your life. The other $700,000 can be used to satisfy this judgment.
All right. Well, we're not attorneys to back that up, but there was a Supreme Court hearing ruling on this
in the last
2 or 3 years.
Yeah, it wasn't that long ago.
That basically said money in an IRA, that if the money started in an ERISA-sponsored plan, which these are, Employee Retirement Income Security Act, if they start in an ERISA-sponsored plan, they are protected up to $1 million.
So if the money comes from your 401k and gets rolled into an IRA and it's less than that $1 million, it affords the same protection in the IRA that was provided under the 401k.
Oh, interesting.
And that's relatively new.
The last couple of years.
That's relatively new because there was a point in the past that if someone thought that they were open to great liability or had a case pending, that you would say to them, just leave the money at the company pension plan.
Well, and as you get older, you're more interested in keeping it than you are in making more. And so it's just sort of a defensive thought that I had, and I was just sort of curious, what your comments
were. Yeah, because a few years ago, John, if you called a few years ago, we said it's anybody's guess. And that's why somebody took it all the way to the Supreme Court, and that's what the current ruling is on the Supreme Court.
So appreciate the call.
Yeah, and one thing you can do, John, one thing to keep in mind is a liability insurance, an umbrella policy. The more money you have, the more insurance you need, and it's relatively inexpensive as a way to protect some assets. Because if you're involved and there's some sort of claim against you, and you have assets, even if in retirement accounts, an attorney might want to go after them. And so
you even have to defend against it, even if you win.
Yeah. So anyway, that's something to keep in mind for anybody with assets. Umbrella insurance makes a ton of sense. The clock tells us we need to take a quick break. If you want to join the program, 921-1530, or you can send us a question at questions@moneymatters.com. This is Hanson McLean's Money Matters. Welcome back to Hanson McLean's Money Matters. I'm Scott Hanson.
Pat McLean.
Glad you're still with us today. We talk about the world of finance. And again, to join the show, 921-1530. 15:30. I want to talk about something. I actually wrote an article.
For what, CNBC?
CNBC.com.
Is that, so is that, you, I get copied from internally in our company, articles, but you're on CNBC, are you on Barron sometimes? And I apologize for not paying more attention to where you, the articles from our, that you write on behalf of our firm are published, but CNBC, Barron's, Wall Street Journal, .com, I saw that not too long ago. So where do you, where's your stuff published?
I think most of the stuff in Wall Street Journal comes from the Wall Street Journal reporters themselves, unless you're on the editorial side of things.
Got it.
CNBC, it's mostly CNBC.com. And they periodically ask me for to write an article on something. So I think they use it. But the problem is, one challenge is I have no control of when they're going to actually decide to publish the thing. So they might sit on it for a day. They might sit on it for a month.
So it could be.
I don't know. It's not my problem, I guess. It's their problem.
Well, it's topical when you write it.
I find it topical. And sometimes I'll just write them an opinion piece, and they'll run that.
And do you know how many people read these articles? Do they give you a count? Yeah. So like, just, you know,
no.
Six people, 60,000?
Well, you can see how many forwards you get and how many comments you get. So if I have an article that's been forwarded 80 times. And
then they have some sort of formula. They figure out how
I'm
many people
sure
read this.
I'm sure. Something tells me they probably have it down to a pretty good science on.
Well, the mere fact that they continue to ask means that it's actually working.
For them.
For them.
Yeah.
How about for you?
I don't know. You don't even read them, apparently.
Well, darn it.
You don't know that they exist. I'm sure you read them.
Oh, I read. I can't wait. I bring them home, and my kids and I, we print them out. We pass them
at the
around.
Dinner table.
We pass them around the dinner table.
Okay, you read the first paragraph.
Okay, son, after you finish eating the meatloaf.
Meatloaf. You cook meatloaf?
I love meatloaf.
Oh.
My
mother-in-law.
Potatoes.
And we'll get back to the business at hand here. But my mother-in-law, who passed away unexpectedly about 4 or 5 years ago, God rest her soul, lived right around the corner from us. Phenomenal lady. She was a vegetarian for years, and she and my wife was too. She would make me the best meatloaf. She would combine different, like three different meats together.
Yeah, veal,
yes,
beef, and pork.
Yes. Really good meatloaf. And she would make it just for me.
That was nice.
I know.
Yeah. So I love meatloaf, but no one else in my family will eat it. So about once a year, I
like the meat. Well, anyway. So back to the CNBC.
Well, back to a financial show that
what
this
I was
is.
Talking. It just sounded good. I miss the meatloaf and I miss Betty too. But all right. So back to
the article you wrote for CNBC.
So this is recent in this fall. The Treasury Department comes out and says that we will allow for 401ks to offer annuities as an option. And some of the stuff I read in the financial reports have just been way off. I mean, one thing I read, someone went into this detail about variable annuities and equity index annuities. These aren't the kind of annuities you're going to see in 401ks.
Correct. These are basically, these are to help you provide a stream of income till your dying day without running out of that stream.
Yeah. So I'm reading this one article. It's going into the high cost of variable annuities. I'm like, the person who wrote this had no idea what they're talking about.
They completely missed the mark.
So as Pat, you'd said before, roughly 86% of employees who do not work for the public entities do not have a monthly pension at retirement. They have their 401k, right?
Which they need to turn into a monthly pension.
Somehow, right? You need to turn into somehow.
A stream of income.
So 401ks, and you're going to start seeing this in the next couple of years, where inside your 401k, you're going to have an option, in addition to the target date funds you've got now and the mutual funds you've got now, to have some portion, either while you're still working or at retirement, to go into an annuity. And an annuity in its purest form is essentially an agreement between you and an insurance company, where you give up a chunk of cash today in exchange for a series of payments, typically designed to last you to your dying day, right? So you're 65 years old, you're marching into retirement. Let's say you saved up, let's say you did well and saved $1 million in your 401k, and you're thinking, I'd like to have some portion of this guaranteed. You can say, all right, let's have 200,000 of this, 20% of this, go to this annuity and give me essentially a monthly pension out of that. If I die tomorrow, it's going to be a bad choice on my part because I died early. If I live to be 110, it's going to be the best investment decision I ever made because the insurance company is going to keep paying and paying and paying. So the way it works today, if you want to buy that sort of income stream, that sort of annuity, you need to take the money out of the 401k, roll it to an IRA, and then go find an insurance company, and you'll have an individual contract with the insurance company. The insurance company will have a contract specifically for you. Now, these annuities that are going to be offered inside 401ks, they will have better deals.
They'll be less expensive.
Yeah, and you don't see the cost.
And you won't see it, but it's there.
You'll get greater benefits.
There's a mortality expense.
You'll get have a greater benefit with the ones that
I think it was a great idea. The Department of Labor came in and said the Treasury Department says it's okay.
And I think
it was a great idea.
I do too. I don't see anything wrong with it at all. There's a clearly a time. The challenge today is interest rates are so low that when you buy this, essentially you're locking in.
I disagree.
I just said it was a challenge that the interest rate. I didn't
but
say
you can buy
it.
But you can get a lifetime annuity on a variable annuity, and those things will be allowed in here.
You'll never see them in there.
You don't think so?
No. I'll bet you right now. Not that I'm a betting man.
What do you
but
want?
We can do it.
What
I
do
bet
you want to
in
bet?
The next 5 years, you'll see less than 2% of large employers offer variable annuitization inside their 401k. It's too complicated of a thing. As Pat is correct, and actually a great retirement vehicle would be a variable annuitization.
This inside is where, of 401k.
So here's how complicated this is. You give up a stream of cash today in exchange for a payout of
units.
That the value is going to fluctuate based upon the underlying investment.
But the units are guaranteed to last till you're 90.
Okay, but if the units can't buy you a loaf of bread, who cares? So if you had a variable annuitization through the financial crisis, for example,
your income would have gone down significantly.
You might have been receiving $1,000 a month and suddenly you went down to $500 a month.
But if you live to 120, you'd still have a stream of income. I get that they're probably – I'm going to have to agree with you. I was wrong. They won't be offered.
How many people actually would want to buy a variable?
They're very rare.
Yeah.
I could make an argument for them.
Oh, right? You'll make an argument for
anything. Although I've never used one for a client.
Of course. That backs my point. And I don't think you'd buy one for yourself either.
No.
But then again, you wouldn't buy an immediate annuity for yourself either.
No.
Anyway.
And or would you recommend annuities to most people? An immediate annuity to most people.
Yeah, there are times. Here's one that might make sense. And there are times that when we've offered. Typically, matter of fact, if you're a single person, retirement time, and have no heirs, you're going to be a number one candidate for that because you don't care about leaving anything.
I said typically, I have used them.
That's what I said.
Yeah, especially during the financial crisis, there was kind of a gap between what current interest rates were and what annuitization rates were for about a 6-month period.
I used a couple back then too. These particular so one is if you're more concerned about your lifetime income than you are about what's left behind. That's one.
Number one.
Secondly, is if the financial markets are really spooking you and you're thinking, I need another option besides watching something go up and down in value. I want some insurance company to guarantee a lifetime income. And that's where actually back, and you talk about the financial crisis time, our firm had a few times we would use those for people when the...
It made sense.
Like, I'm getting out. Well,
it made sense.
You need some sort of option to generate your monthly income. But by and large, annuities, the way they're marketed, the way they're sold, the way they are described... by and large, we think people should run away from them.
Yes. I think that there's a place, but it's so rare. It's so rare. And the way that they're sold through most people that actually don't understand how they work.
That's the problem.
That they're sold as a panacea, and they're not. They're complicated. They're expensive.
I mean, for someone to be a certified financial planner, for example... you need to have a lot of education behind you. You need at least 3 years of work experience in the field before you're a certified financial planner. To become
a college degree.
To be an insurance agent, to offer an annuity, a two-week class with a little test at the end? It's not hard. And suddenly...
You can offer these so-called investment products.
And you might have someone as an insurance agent that really doesn't have an understanding of the whole picture of
investment options. You got to be careful. Obviously, we're not huge fans of annuities, but there are rare circumstances where they may make place. Do lots and lots of research if someone's trying to sell you an annuity.
Yeah.
If that's the only thing they're offering you, run away.
Absolutely. Anyway, we need to take a quick break here. A short break. Stick around for more. To join the program, 921-1530 is our contact number, or send us an email, questions@moneymatters.com. This is Hanson McClain's Money Matters. Welcome back to Hanson McClain's Money Matters. I'm Scott Hanson.
I'm Pat McClain. Thanks for joining us. If you'd like to join the show, you have a question regarding your money, 916-921-1530, or you can email us at questions@moneymatters.com. And if you email us, we'll answer your questions on the next show.
Or through an email or something. I don't know what we do.
We'll get the answer.
We'll get the answer, all right.
And you could text us, too. Do you remember the text number?
I don't have it in front of me. We made it this far through the show, so I don't have it in front of me.
All right.
But we didn't take these calls because they've been holding here for a while.
Thank you very much for holding, Linda.
Hi there.
Hi, Linda.
Hi. All your callers and your comments lead to more questions, but I'll speak to my original question. I understand about the step-up value if you inherit a property, and that is true for both joint tenancy and in a trust. Is that correct?
If you hold it, whatever. So a trust doesn't do anything with the titling of the property.
Okay.
So however it was held going into the trust is how it's going to be taxed coming out.
Okay. And then when if you have two people, one passes away, it gets stepped up. And then does it get stepped up again when the second person dies?
Yeah, if it wasn't put into a bypass trust.
So years ago, if you remember, not that many years ago, the maximum you could transfer upon your death for estate tax purposes was $600,000. And there was a lot of people in the middle class that because they had a home in California, that and a 401k, they exceeded the $600,000 limit. Now, that has went to $1 million. Now it's up to $5 million.
Which was curious, but that's the way they did it.
Most middle class, it doesn't impact anymore. But back, there are some people, and we see them today, that there was, because of that $600,000 limit on when the first spouse passed away, if their assets exceeded that $600,000, there was a bypass trust created, an AB trust, or there's different names for them. But it's essentially, it was a trust that was designed to be set up to preserve both husband and wife's $600,000 exemption. For the deceased spouse portion, that does not receive a second stepped-up basis.
Okay.
So the reason, and I know it's $5 million today, so there might be some listeners thinking, well, we're not $5 million. But for someone who passed away, we see this often.
But, Scott, I've had clients that working with their attorneys that they've dissolved these bypass trusts while the surviving spouse is still alive.
Okay. So don't put it in the bypass.
And it depends on where there's a second marriage and stuff, then you're going to have a real challenge.
Yeah. So your question is, the answer to your question is it may or may not receive a step.
Usually it does.
It usually does. Did you fund a bypass trust at the first death?
Okay. My husband and I are both here, and we're looking at future.
Oh, you're fine then. You're fine.
Yeah. So we should not, upon the death of one, should not create that bypass trust.
Unless your net worth is more than $10 million.
Okay. And then
$5 million.
$5 million. Okay. If some of it's rental property, does depreciation, do we have to recapture that depreciated value or anything? Or is it just all stepped up and we start again?
I forget.
I used to know the answer on the depreciated. Okay. I don't know what the current tax rules are.
Okay.
You used to have to recapture, but I don't remember if it's the same or not now.
Yeah, with the change in the last, because the estate tax stuff just changed.
I don't know about the recapture of the depreciation.
That's a tax question. So for our children, if they inherit the property, and if we haven't put the bypass, they will get the stepped-up value.
That is correct.
So they decide at that time whether to sell or keep the property if it's appropriate.
That's right.
Under current law.
Does the property tax go up when it gets stepped up, or does it maintain the cost basis for the property tax?
Is it a rental property?
Well, we have two houses and two rental properties.
If it's not sold, then, it depends on who inherits the property.
Okay. If it's a
If it's a primary residence,
okay,
and a child moves into it and converts it to their primary residence, they can continue under the Prop 13, continue the same cost tax structure. Otherwise, it can be reassessed for fair market value.
Okay, so like the rental properties would have to be reassessed then.
Correct.
They could have to, yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, that and every question, every caller, I think of new questions, but
yeah,
I'll leave it with that.
And you know, and Linda?
Mm-hmm.
So just remember, you sound relatively young. You could do all the best planning in the world, and we could answer all the questions correctly.
And the tax laws change.
Exactly. This Prop 13, quite frankly, it has become an albatross for the state of California.
I think there'll be some change in the next decade on it.
Yeah,
that's my guess.
It
has become quite the albatross. But thank you. Thanks for the call.
Okay, yeah. And thank you very much.
All right. Thanks, Linda. Bye-bye. You know, it's interesting about the Prop 13. When it was designed, clearly it was designed with good intentions, and it helped a lot of people. I mean, it doesn't make any sense when you have a retired person who has to move out of their house because the property taxes are getting too much.
Correct.
But now when you've got
commercial properties, too.
Commercial properties as well, right? There's commercial properties under Prop 13. And you've got, but where you really see it is you've got a young family moving into an area. The median priced house in San Francisco is now over $1 million, right?
So their taxes on.
So let's say that you're a young family buying a house in San Francisco. You would say it's $1 million, the median priced house. It's $1 million. You're paying $10,000 a year in property taxes. Your next door neighbor, they might be a fat cat for all you know. They might have tons of retirement income.
Yeah, they're big old fat cats.
And they're paying
500?
$800 a year property taxes. At some point in time, there's enough younger voters are going to say, this is just not.
This isn't right.
This isn't right. I have no idea.
And commercial property, it actually slows down commerce a little bit on the commercial property side.
Because people don't want to get rid of the property.
Because if they go out and reinvest in a new property, their property tax goes up depending upon what they paid for the original property. So there will be changes.
Yeah. 921-1530. Let's talk to Karen. Karen, you're with Hanson McLean's Money Matters.
Thank you.
Hi, Karen.
I have a situation. I will be a recipient of a large sum of money being awarded to me. It's pending.
Okay.
And I'm not of age of retirement, but I could be. And I want to know how can I invest it? Because I have two offspring that are still in school age.
And when you say your children, how old are they?
They're 26 and 25.
Okay.
And how much money are you going to be receiving, ballpark?
I'm listening to the caller before. Did you say the $5 million?
Uh-huh.
And around that number?
Okay.
Could be more or less.
Wow.
And have you invested in the past? Have you?
I do have annuities because I'm still working.
So when you say annuity, did you purchase the annuity through your payroll, or did you buy them
yes.
in the open? Okay, so that tells us that you're actually a saver.
Yes.
Here, this is really interesting because it's difficult because here's why: these dollars can change your life for the good, or change your life for the bad, right?
And you could act like it's all the money in the world, and it could be gone. In 5 years.
Or 10 years.
I've seen it happen.
Or invested poorly.
Or given to friends or relatives or become one of those, someone that lives beyond their means for a relatively short period of time. So the first thing you should actually do is nothing.
There's no hurry on anything.
There's no hurry. Do you own a home now?
Yes.
Okay. So
here's what I would do. If you were my sister, right? If you were my sister... I would say I would go interview 3 or 4 fee-based financial advisors, independent financial advisors.
Okay.
And I would just, with no intention of making any decision yet, and I would say, here's my situation. Here's what I'm receiving. What would you recommend from a financial planning standpoint? How should we view these dollars, right?
Okay.
Now, a good advisor is going to spend a little time talking about Karen, trying to figure out what Karen's hopes and goals could be with these dollars, et cetera. And we'll focus on kind of a long-term plan. How do we, what can these dollars do for the rest of Karen's life? How can it impact kids and other family members or whatever?
A bad advisor is going to actually go right to product and start making recommendations
about
of,
investments
of particular products.
Oh, we could put this in this REIT or we can put this in that. Anyone who tries to and that sort of thing, run away from.
Okay.
It would be the equivalent of you going to a doctor and them not talking to you very much and then just start prescribing.
But that's what happens often in our industry because it's people that are they're product salesmen. They call themselves financial advisors, but they're not really. They're really kind of product salespeople. But if you get a good advisor, someone who's fee-based, who does not have an incentive to sell you any product, granted they might have, they would like to have you as a client because they'd like to help you manage those dollars, but they do it on a fee basis, not trying to sell you anything. They would be agnostic compared to what they'd recommend you. But if a good advisor will actually take the time and help you map out a long-term strategy, here's what you can actually afford to spend on an annual basis. If you go out and spend $500,000 on a motor coach, here's the impact it's going to have,
and they'll
want to
pay. They'll probably want to pay down your debt. And if you're living in a home you're comfortable with,
absolutely pay.
If you're living in a home you're comfortable with, they'll want to pay that off. And if you want to upgrade a little bit, which it sounds like you may be able to do, they'll pay that home off.
You don't want any debt.
Yeah, you do not want any debt. You were at the point in time where you don't have to have debt.
Do not.
So don't have debt.
So I want to invest a certain part, a percentage of the winnings, like a foundation to a medical group.
Got it.
Fantastic.
Easy to do.
You might want to get that structure. You'll want to do that the same year you receive these dollars. So if it's in 2014, you'll want to have something set up in 2014.
So that you get the deduction in the year, the charitable deduction in the year in which you do it. So it may require sitting down with an advisor
sooner than later.
And there's easy ways to do it. One is you can put the money into a charitable trust. They're held at Fidelity and Schwab. The other is you can put it into a regional foundation. Sacramento has one. El Dorado County has one.
If you have a certain charity in mind now, you can just
gift it straight across.
Yeah.
So, in fact, we had a meeting at work last week about that exact.
The same year you received the winnings.
So, anyway, take it slow. Take it slow, Karen. Appreciate the call.
Yeah, unfortunately, we're running out of time. But this could change your life for the good or not, depending on how things are.
And we've seen both.
We have seen both. And, of course, we've all seen the shows and read the stories about those that it hasn't worked out so well for. But, again, I would find a financial advisor who's clearly looking out for your best interest, a fee-based advisor that doesn't have some incentive to try to sell you something. And I think it's great that you're looking at giving some money to charity. Where your treasure is, there your heart tends to follow also. Anyway, we are out of time. We are here every Saturday. We broadcast from Saturday from 10 to 11 and have a rebroadcast Sundays from 2 to 3. Visit our website at hansonmclain.com, and you can sign up for a podcast of this program and all kinds of other good information. We will see you next week.